Call the Resource Committee meeting to order. Today is March 25th, it's 8:30. In attendance today, we have Representatives Herman, Dunn, Miller, Wallace, and Schultz. We have various sites throughout the state that are with us on teleconferencing to listen. And primarily, the first thing that we're going to do in the first two hearings that we have scheduled is primarily informational as far as the committee is concerned, to bring the committee up to speed on this piece of legislation. We will be going back, and all the people that are on the teleconferencing sites, you will have an opportunity in the future, as additional teleconferences are scheduled, to participate and to testify before the Resource Committee. This is the first meeting that we've had on this piece of legislation, and we're trying to be get up to speed on exactly what's going on and why the bill is necessary. So, at this time, we'd like to go to Anchorage, and we'd like to have Department of Law speak first. I can barely hear you.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, in talking and discussing this briefly before the meeting got started, we thought that perhaps it would be worthwhile if the Department of Fish and Game and the Department of Law tied our presentation together so that you could see clearly an overview of how the administration has developed the position that we have with regard to the Madison decision, and consequently House Bill 288, which is before you today. Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'll do just a brief overview.
Okay, would you name and identify yourself?
I'm Jim Ayers. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game. And, Mr. Chairman, the Department, as well as the Department of Law, certainly appreciates the opportunity to come before you and discuss House Bill 288 and, most specifically, the Madison decision. The administration, the Department of Law, and the Department of Fish and Game is here to work with you in the spirit of cooperation. We want to work closely with you, providing you with all information that we have with regard to management questions surrounding this recent decision, as well as request your assistance and guidance in developing a position that will bring an immediate and thorough resolution to this potential issue. What we prepared for the committee this morning, Mr. Chairman, is a brief overview that would give you in this presentation a review of the Madison decision and the legal holdings that are related to that Madison decision, the potential implications with regard to federal law, and what we perceive to be the potential impact on the users as a result of the Madison decision. With that said, Mr. Chairman, I'd also like to introduce who the people that I believe are in Anchorage. From the Department of Law, it is Larry Spengler. That I know because I just heard her voice. In addition to Ms. Spengler from the Department of Law, Steve Penoyer, the Deputy Commissioner for Fisheries, is in Anchorage. With Steve is, we think, at this point, Ken Florey, who is a regional supervisor. From the boards, Ron Jolin, who is the chairman of the Fisheries Board, as well as the chairman of the Joint Fish and Game Boards, and Bix Bonney, and perhaps other board members. I will, with that introduction, perhaps turn it over to Steve Penoyer, who perhaps in this situation be our anchor person, if you will. And with that brief introduction, Mr. Chairman, perhaps the thing to do is to have Steve Penoyer introduce whoever is in Anchorage to make that presentation. And that would then, he could then introduce both the board members that may be there to tell you the board's perspective, as well as a representative from the Department of Law to give a clear legal representation of the administration's position on the Madison decision.
Turn that up, please.
Yeah.
Yes, go ahead, Steve.
Yes, thank you. As Jim introduced, we're going to go ahead and give you the perspective from different Board of Fisheries, the Department of Law, and the Department of Fish and Game's standpoint on the implications of the Madison decision. And I know the time's limited, so without further introductory remarks, I'm going to introduce Ron Joel and Beth Stewart and Beck Spani. Ron is the chairman of the Board of Fisheries. Beth Stewart is the director of the boards, and Beck Spani is a board member from Anchorage, to give you some idea of the board's perspective on how the Madison decision affects management of fisheries in the state.
Lucy, you can have that. Beth?
My understanding, Steve, is that Ron Jolin, the chairman of the Board of Fisheries and the joint chairman of the boards, is to speak next. Is that correct?
I think he's trying to get on, Mr. Chairman.
Is he with you there, Steve?
Representatives Cato, Jenkins, and Thompson.
Are you picking us up in Juneau now?
We can hear you now. Is that you, Ron?
Yeah, good morning. I'll try to make this as brief as possible. I think from the board's perspective, you know, our mandate under Title 16 is the protection and enhancement of the resource and the equitable distribution of that resource to the user groups. I think that our feelings are that prior to the Madison decision, the board had the flexibility to manage the resources of the state for their protection and enhancement and utilization by all the user groups. The Madison decision does complicate our job as board members, and we are in a position of really, as joint boards, of wanting to get back to where we were prior to this decision. We thought we were doing a fairly good job with the tools that we had to work with, and I think the system was indeed working. So with that, I'll turn it over to Beth, and she can touch on some of the other aspects of the joint boards.
This is Beth Stewart. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, Beth.
The joint boards of Fisheries and Game are meeting in session now. It's a regular session, and they're considering proposed changes to the regulations that were called for several months ago. Neither board has legal notice at this meeting to deal with the Madison decision in any forward-looking way, but both boards are going to be considering the kinds of action they believe the state should take absent any change in the legislation on towards the end of their meeting. For the Fisheries Board, the end of the meeting should be tomorrow. For the Game Board, the 2nd or 3rd of April. Part of the problem for both boards is that because they don't have legal notice to make any major changes in the regulations or hold major public hearings, is they're going to have to sort of guess about how things will work this summer. Larry Spangler can speak to how unclear the requirements will be for the board under Madison and the sort of cloudy state that put board decisions in, for board advice in for this summer. Because the Fisheries Board is not able to hold the regular kind of public hearing and regulation session that it would normally do, we may be looking at petitions this summer to change the way we operate some of our fisheries. And I guess at this point, the most difficult part of this decision is just the uncertainty about what latitude the board has and what kinds of things the board may be asked to do. And perhaps Larry Spangler could explain the decision a little bit more before we get too far into this.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think we'll ask Larry Spangler from the Department of Law next to do just that, to go into the legal aspects of the Madison decision and how it may affect the board actions. Thank you.
This is Larry Spangler from the Department of Law. Can you hear me in Juneau?
Yes, go ahead, Larry.
Madison versus Department of Fish and Game is the first time that the state Supreme Court has had the opportunity to look at the state's assistance law, and in doing so, dramatically undid the interpretation that the boards had been putting upon that law up to that point. Before the Madison decision, the boards had been authorizing as subsistence uses hunting and fishing in rural communities and areas, which the boards determined under a criteria they had developed were areas where subsistence uses occurred. This did not mean that people from other parts of the state were unable to hunt and fish on those particular fish stocks or populations. Generally, the other Alaskans' opportunities were provided for through commercial fishing, sport fishing, and personal use fishing, and through just the general game regulations on the two different board sides. The fact that subsistence uses were restricted to rural harvests prior to Madison allowed the board a fair amount of leeway to balance all the other interest groups. For example, on the Board of Fisheries side, personal use fishing was established as a category in regulation, a mechanism by which the board could authorize net fishing for people who could not qualify for subsistence uses under the board's aid criteria. And that net fishing for personal use could be accommodated as well as sport fishing, which is fishing by rod and reel for personal use, as well as commercial fishing, which is fishing for profit. What Madison does is take away some of the board's flexibility as far as how to deal with these different use groups. In Madison, the Supreme Court held several things. The court held that the legislature in 1978 had not intended for the subsistence law, to identify subsistence uses as rural uses. It had not intended that the boards identify subsistence uses based on uses of a community or area, and conversely, had not intended that the boards set up some kind of a limited entry system on an individual-by-individual basis. The court said that if subsistence uses on a fish stock or game population had been in existence, the boards had to authorize those unless the resource would be hurt. And if they authorized those uses, then anyone in Alaska, any Alaskan, had to be able to participate unless non-subsistence uses had been eliminated. In the fishery side, those uses would be sport and commercial, and on the game side, those uses would be non-state residents, hunting, and big game guiding. So the situation that we're left with is that the boards can identify subsistence uses still. If a fish stock or game population has been subject to subsistence uses, that hunting or fishing has to be authorized. Subsistence uses after Madison cannot be defined or identified in terms of the eight criteria, but is rather any hunting for personal consumption by an Alaska resident or any fishing by net by an Alaska resident for personal consumption. If the fishery is open, all Alaskans must be able to participate and cannot be restricted in doing so until or unless commercial and sport fishing on the associated fish stock has been closed. The theoretical explanations that I've just given become a little more real when you think in terms of specifics. And I know that Ken Florian and perhaps Steve Snyder will get into this a little bit more detail, but just to throw in a couple of more constructs here. Before Madison, the Board of Fisheries had identified subsistence uses in the Cook Inlet area as existing in three communities, and therefore did not authorize subsistence fishing anywhere else in the inlet, but rather had authorized personal use fishing on the sockeye in the summer and a limited personal use fishery on the coho in the fall. Now, if anyone petitions to have an area open that had previously been open in Cook Inlet, since subsistence fishing, that area will have to be opened by the board under the Madison decision. Subsistence fishing and hunting will not take place in an unregulated fashion now, but those regulations have to reflect customary and traditional use levels. So individual bag limits in fisheries, for example, would have to be equivalent to what the customary and traditional bag limits had been. That those could not be abridged again without include two sets of facts to face. One is the removal of some of the board's flexibility and the potential disruption to other use groups because of that lack of flexibility. The other is a possible inconsistency with federal law. The federal subsistence law, ANILCA, allows the state to continue management on all federal land, in this, all public land defined as federal land in the state, as long as the state provides for three different things in law. One is the advisory system, which we have, the communities and regional councils. One is the priority for subsistence uses, which we have. And the third is the definition of subsistence uses, which allows identification of subsistence uses as rural uses. The Supreme Court in Madison seems to have said quite clearly that the 1978 legislature has not authorized the board to identify subsistence uses as rural uses, and that at least first blush poses a problem. If we were found to be non-compliant, we would lose our management to some degree or another over 60% of the land in the state, and arguably, although the state would not concede this, certainly, the argument has been made that we would lose management over navigable waters as well. Additionally, we would lose $1 million in federal matching money that we receive from the federal government under ANILCA. It is impossible to predict exactly what format some kind of federal management would take, but it is important to remember that this would not be totally up to the discretion of the federal government. If it were assumed that the federal government did not want to come in and take over management, that would not be the end of the question, because the Title VIII of ANILCA provides for judicial enforcement, and an individual who goes into federal court through the federal government asserts that the state was not in compliance and take over and ask that the federal government be ordered to step in. With that overview, I'll turn it back over to Steve Sonoyer to introduce the next section of the presentation.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Larry. I think what we'll do next is to talk about a few what-ifs in individual fisheries as examples, and then perhaps we can answer questions. The Board of Fisheries is in session. They're going to have to leave by about 9:30 or so to get back to the board meeting. First, let me say that in terms of the effects of Madison, it needs to be clearly understood that there are allocative effects, that the Department of Fish and Game has the authority still, as does the board, to manage for conservation reasons. So we're not talking about something that's going to have a long-term resource effect in terms of managing the resource. What we're talking about is allocation between users and what ground rules are used to make those allocations. I think what we'd like to start with is Cook Inlet, and between Ken Flory, myself, and Vic Spani, we'll cover that as an example, and then go on to talk a bit about the Copper River, although there are other examples statewide. These may serve the purpose, unless there are further questions. Cook Inlet, we have system now where we have subsistence fisheries defined as being exclusively Tayonek, English Bay, and Port Graham. And it seems fairly obvious that under the interpretation we've got, that these fisheries would have to be open to, rather than just the residents of those areas, to all comers. The exact impact of this, depending on who fishes and how many people would actually do it, are not totally clear. Obviously, in the case of Tayonek, which has been a limited fishery, fishing on Susitna River king stocks, if in fact there was a major participation, this would impact the recreational fisheries in the Susitna drainage. Second category we're dealing with is the one that was termed personal use. And there are personal use fisheries now in existence. The board has created in Cook Inlet. The board's going to have to look at those in terms of the participation, not limiting the participation, since they would become subsistence fisheries if they continue to exist in the present fashion, and would have a priority. These personal use fisheries include fisheries on late coho on the Kenai beaches and earlier sockeyes and kings in the Kasilof River mouth. In terms of how much these fisheries could be expanded, I guess we don't have any specific way of judging what the use would be in these fisheries. The late coho fishery was originally mandated prior to the board's criteria by court action, and does take place on a run that is also taken by sportsmen, and where there is has been a lot of controversy and discussion over the size of that allocation. Other areas in Cook Inlet have in the past had documented subsistence fisheries and net fisheries, and depending on where they were opened early in the season. Most of the early run kings, sockeye, have been set aside for recreational use. There have been commercial closures, personal use closures during that period of time. Obviously, if fisheries were opened at that time, people participated, it would impact existing recreational fisheries. With that brief introduction, I'm going to ask Board Member Vic Spani to say a few words on the Kirkland situation.
Are you reading me all right in Juneau?
Loud and clear.
Thank you very much. It's Vic Spani. I'd like to very briefly take it from the generality to the specifics, and what I think would be the first moment of truth that we come up against and where our first real problems occur. For those of you who are not familiar, we have some major streams on the Kenai Peninsula other than the Kenai River, the Anchor River and the Hilchek Deep Creek and Crooked Creek that takes a large amount of recreational fishing. Memorial Day weekend is the moment I'm looking forward to with a lot of trepidation if we don't have some change. But approximately, according to the newspaper, 20,000 people descend on these recreational rivers during that weekend. The beaches that are just adjacent to the rivers, Nanilchek Beach, Coho Beach, and so on, have the early run king salmon going up them. The rivers themselves are small rivers, and consequently, they don't have a heavy, big run of king salmon, early run kings. Yet the recreational value on those early run kings are extremely important to the urban center just to the north. But specifically, what I would be worried about and some of the problems the board is going to experience is when a large amount of recreational fishermen are on these recreational streams, at the same time, by Madison decision, there could be anywhere from a minor to a major subsistence fishery by nets going on the adjacent beaches. It takes very little catch of the early run king salmon to force the board to close the recreational fishing in these small streams that are so important. And I am not looking forward to facing 20,000 irate fishermen when we close or if we have to close these particular streams due to the subsistence fishing that we'd have to allow to be open on the adjacent beaches. That's just one specific that we're going to be looking forward to, and it'll be early. It'll be towards the end of May. Other things I'm sure will happen, but that's the one I wanted to address.
We're gone.
Thank you, Bex, Mr. Chairman. I guess what is coming out of that is that in the early and late part of the seasons in Coconut, the runs are relatively smaller and have been primarily allocated to recreational fisheries. And certainly, impacts of any increase in subsistence harvest at this time would be felt far more than anything during the bulk of the season when major runs are going through. Perhaps the next section we could briefly discuss is the Copper River, since I know this has been brought up in a number of different forms.
Steve,
and Florey and I will briefly go over the regulations and how the fishery is managed and what the possible impacts are. Copper River sockeye run and king runs come through Prince William Sound. Commercial fisheries about a month in advance of the time that they reach the upriver subsistence and what has now been called personal use fisheries. Decisions on what's going to be done in terms of allocation to upriver fisheries have to be made ahead of time. They can't be really made in season. So, in effect, we have to have an escapement goal through the commercial fishery that includes both the biological requirements of the run and whatever allocation is going to be set for the upriver fisheries. And once that's made, you fairly well have to live with it, because by the time you found out that there weren't enough fish upriver to satisfy some demand, really be too late to adjust in the commercial fishery, and obviously you're not required to take out of the escapement. The board has, in recent history, approached this by putting a quota on the personal use segment of the harvest of 60,000 fish and making an estimate of what the subsistence harvest would be at about 20,000. So a total fish allocation of about 80,000 fish. That's then added to the top of the escapement goal, which is 411,000 fish. And the resultant accumulative run is what is fished on upriver as well as providing biological escapement. If, in fact, the fishery was one open to all comers, and second of all, did not have, in essence, a limit that it was going to be kept within regardless. In other words, you had to basically satisfy the demand of whatever number of participants were going to come into the fishery. It seems like that would have to happen in some progressive fashion. The board initially would have to estimate what was required to satisfy the demand. River have varied as high as estimated about 110,000, 120,000 fish, and not just last year, but in previous years. It would seem that initially you'd have to just take an estimate of what would satisfy that demand and go for that for the first season. After that, of course, it's not so clear that the fishery could be limited in terms of, well, obviously not participation, and probably not in terms of total harvest. So it'd be sort of a demand equation, and in the future, a commercial fishery would have to be regulated to achieve that allocation plus the escapement goal. Ron, perhaps Ken Florio, do you have anything to add to that?
Yes, dear, Mr. Chairman, this is Ken Florio, Regional Supervisor of Commercial Fisheries. I think one important point to discuss on Copper River is the contribution of the Delta stocks, which are the sockeye stocks that don't enter into that personal use or subsistence fishery at Chitna and on up to Solana. The runtime is such that they are over, they have about the same runtime in coming through the commercial fishery, and at the last 2 years on the rebuilding runs, they've contributed about half of the returning sockeye to the Copper River and Copper River Basin. If we had to make a major readjustment of fishing time in the commercial fishery to allow for upriver escapement, first for biological needs and second for the subsistence needs, we would have to then forego a large percentage of the harvest on the Delta stocks, of which there would be no other opportunity to harvest after the commercial fishery. That's the only point I want to make.
One other point, this is Steve Norrie again, Mr. Chairman, that I might make is that in the past there's been differential bag limits between the personal use and subsistence fisheries, with bag limits for personal use being in the order of about 30, and the subsistence bag limits being up in the several hundred range. Obviously, if it's a subsistence fishery, that distinction probably could not be made. Mr. Chairman, that's about all we have. There are other fisheries around the state that may be affected, but I think these are two of the major examples. Perhaps what we can do now is answer questions and then make ourselves available until about 9:30 when the board has to go back in session, if that would meet your desires.
At this time, for information, we're not going to open it up to questions because you folks are going to have the opportunity to come back down to Juneau, and I know the committee members will have specific questions that they want to address you with. So we're going to withhold questions at this time. If there's anything else that you would like to add at this time, we'd appreciate it if you do so.
Mr. Chairman, Steve, unless the board members have something more to say, I know the board wants to get back into session, and the committee here is going to move on to other business. I'm going to make a closing comment unless you have something else that the board members would like to say up in Anchorage.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Jolin would like to make one final statement.
Thank you, and Mr. Chairman. The potential management problems in the fisheries are of great concern to the boards. I think the Copper River fishery is probably foremost in our mind because that's the one we dealt with last year. There's a question as to how many fish we need to put into the river to accommodate the subsistence fishery. And Mr. Florio has brought out the fact that there are Delta stocks that are of great concern. And I think one of the main concerns of the board is just how much we would have to curtail the commercial fishery in order to accommodate that upriver fishery. And the board is struggling with these issues. So I think all of the issues have been brought to the attention of the members of your committee. I hope that you have a copy of the resolution that the joint board put together. With that, we do have to get back to continue the business of the Board of Fish. I would like to thank you for being with us this morning and for the participation on your end as well as our end.
If that's it from Anchorage, we'd like to thank you for taking the time off, and I know you guys are on a busy schedule down there, and we appreciate you taking time to come over to inform the Resources Committee of the necessity or the importance of this legislation. With that, I'd like to remind the teleconference sites that we will in the future, as we get more hearings scheduled, we will be involving all of the network sites on the teleconference, and we will allow the people to come forth at that time and to testify on this legislation. So with that, we're going to, unless you've got something to add, Jim.
I just have one final comment, Mr. Chairman, and that is that we will make ourselves available to you to this committee or any member of this committee to provide you as much information as we possibly can. We respectfully but strongly request your assistance as well as your guidance in resolving what we believe to be a very important issue and restoring regulatory flexibility to the boards that will ensure that Alaskans are provided a fair and reasonable access to our fish stocks and game populations. We think by working together we can resolve the issue that is before us, but it is a serious public policy question that we think that by working together with you we can resolve. And again, if we can be of any assistance to you at any time, we are available. Thank you very much for this opportunity this morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Okay, thank you. And with that, we'll be shutting off the teleconferencing at this time and going on to the regular meeting. Okay, the first person we have to testify on this legislation is Ron Somerville.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ron Somerville, representing the Alaska Outdoor Council, located here in Juneau for the time being. I'd like to start off my testimony on this HB 288 with just a brief comment about, I think, the council. One, I've said before, and most of you are aware, we represent 44 clubs throughout Alaska, and we're not primarily an urban organization. We have membership in Petersburg, and Ketchikan, Sitka, Tok, Delta, Kodiak, and what I'm saying is that we're not just talking, it's not, when we testify, it's not just urban versus rural, or in fact, the sportsman versus subsistence user, which is unfortunately the way the subsistence issue has been classed many times. I myself have lived in Alaska 46 years. I grew up in a small village here in Southeastern, and when I worked 20 years with the department, I traveled throughout a good part of the state, so I'm pretty well familiar with conditions in rural Alaska, if you will. I think the purpose of the hearing, as you've indicated here, is to get information, so I'll try to bypass the emotional and the rhetoric as much as possible. I think there's some things we would like to have you look at. The council has a position, has had for a long time, that if we have a subsistence law, it has to be based on some equitable criteria of need, that the present process and the present methods for providing subsistence is almost undefinable, and the boards have, as you're well aware, almost bogged down in a complete quagmire trying to develop regulations to, in fact, implement the law. The other point is, we're talking about a very fundamental constitutional question, and as Jim Ayer said here recently, major public policy. Those are the sort of things you don't treat lightly, and I would urge you to take your time. I'm not saying there isn't, may be some urgency, but take your time in dealing with it so that people throughout the state have an adequate opportunity to participate. I think that one of the things I can offer the committee is a little bit of historical perspective, which from my personal standpoint, as well as executive director of the Outdoor Council. In 1978, the state subsistence law passed, and as some of you are well aware, under some threat of getting potential subsistence legislation put into federal law. But I think the Supreme Court has accurately interpreted what was the intent of the 1978 legislation. If you look at the limited available history on that, comments by Nels Anderson on the floor, he did not intend to eliminate the dip netters from Fairbanks. Comments about people taking fish and wildlife for food in Alaska and importance, historical importance to them. So what people were told in Alaska during that time was, if you take fish and wildlife for food, you're a subsistence user. I personally sat in a place in Anchorage just prior to the passage of that law with about 300 or 400 people present, and Roger Lang told us exactly that. I don't know why people in Anchorage are so upset with this law, because if you take it for food, you're a subsistence user. And I emphasize that because I do not think, my own personal opinion, that the subsistence law would have passed in 1978 had you had the word rural in it. There's no way it would have passed, because everybody thought they were a subsistence user, and I think that's an important point to dwell on. In 1981, ANILCA passed, of course, inserting the word rural. I was at the time involved with the governor's task force on the whole issue of ANILCA and working back in Washington, D.C. I objected vociferously and spent 2 hours with Governor Hammond asking him specifically to request that the word rural be removed from the subsistence law because it put us in direct conflict with the state statute. The governor was told by the Attorney General's office at that time we did not have to have We did not have to delete the word rural from the federal law because we could, through the authorities of the boards and without changing the state law, be in compliance with the federal law. The same attorneys that are now have just recently lost a Supreme Court ruling, same attorneys are telling you how to get out of this mess. That's what they told the governor back in 1981. Since that time, this administration has been on a course which the Supreme Court has ruled, which I think many people have said was illegal, of providing the word rural implementation of the federal law, whatever rural means, by the way, through administrative action. That led us to what? One major problem. In 1982, the initiative was put in front of the public, objecting to, in fact, the way the law was being implemented. I think that's a crucial point. People were upset. One, because there weren't any subsistence regulations on the boards in some place. Look at all the particular court cases we have going in the state, whether it be Venati or other places. They're saying, hey, I'm not giving a subsistence priority. Where are those regulations saying you're going to implement the law? For some reason, the boards decided to take a very laborious process and only provide a subsistence priority when, in fact, somebody complains. Or the boards go through a very long, lengthy investigative process. Unfortunately, that isn't what the law said. For instance, in Southeastern, we only have essentially one subsistence use. That's Mitchell Bay for Angoon. Does that mean that nobody else in Southeastern participates in subsistence? Well, excuse me, we do have, I guess, a subsistence taking on abalone and Sitka. Does that mean nobody in Craig, where I grew up, or Heidelberg, or Kowak have a subsistence use? No. The board just chose not to give it a priority. They're taking care of it under sport and commercial regulations. But the law says you must eliminate those sport and commercial uses if, in fact, you're going to restrict subsistence. My question is, if you're providing seasons, bag limits, and methods and mean restrictions on subsistence users in these locations, why aren't you eliminating sport and commercial uses? Is there a reason for that? The initiative was spawned partly on that, and the other reason is people feel they're being disenfranchised by the process that the boards were using to implement the law. 80,000 people voted for the initiative. I was very deeply involved with that, and unfortunately, I guess on the losing side, but my purpose for getting involved is to try to get us out of this horrible situation of pitting people in the state versus each other, and that's exactly what the subsistence law was doing. Everybody was thinking they were a subsistence user, but when push came to shove, the regulations didn't demonstrate that. However, the initiative was soundly defeated, but if you look back at why it was defeated, it's because people were promised a fix, a permanent fix to the law. Many legislators campaigned against the initiative on, we're going to go to Juneau and we're going to do it right. The governor campaigned and promised a task force and laying this issue to rest once and for all. I don't have to elaborate on what's happened since the election of the governor 2 years ago. I debated many people, including Roger Painter, who was in the audience, works for one of the legislators, and he agreed that the basic law was flawed and needed to be corrected. Why hasn't it? Many editors and newspapers around the state, their editorials were, yes, the law should be fixed, no, the initiative is not the right way to do it. We should go back, have the legislature go through a deliberate process and fix the law. There are many problems with the law that are not addressed in the governor's bill. One, you have the word priority versus preference. The state constitution allows for preferences amongst beneficial users. It doesn't say anything about priority. Is there a distinct legal difference between priority and preference? Our Supreme Court just said priority means the ultimate. You must eliminate the other uses before you restrict subsistence. I think it's fairly clear what priority means. Or do we really mean, gee, with a guy out in the bush who's got to have an extra moose or a caribou during the year, we have some selective enforcement process, or we have a season that gives him a couple more months to take his moose and caribou because he's out there trapping during the winter. I think that's what preference really means. And I think that's really what a lot of people intend when they talk about subsistence uses. We haven't defined customary and traditional. The board did through its 8 and 10-point criteria. However, the courts have stricken that down. What is customary and traditional? It means different things to different people, different villages. Means different things. The state law says you must eliminate competitive uses. That's exactly the point I made 2 years ago when I debated the subsistence issue. Unfortunately, I got fired, but the governor can't get 5 Supreme Court justices, unfortunately. The law says you must restrict. You must eliminate these uses before you restrict subsistence. The point I was making before is, what does restrict mean? We've got to have some definition of that. That mean you can means no closed season, no bag limit, no methods and means for a subsistence user? Or does it mean you have a reasonable season and reasonable regulations? You still have to adhere to certain types of, let's call them customary regulations we've developed in recent years. A lot of the people, however, in the bush, and you're well aware, believes they should be allowed to take geese in the spring when they're on the nesting ground. And they believe they should be able to take moose in the summer or caribou in the spring. And so it's been a long process trying to convince some of the villages some of the more conservation-oriented methods are to their own benefit. But my point is, can you restrict these uses before you eliminate the others? I think it's something that the legislature has to address. One other point is we're not in compliance with ANILCA and the term customary trade. Customary trade in ANILCA allows for the commercial sale of some fish and wildlife resources. Does that mean, as we had before, a sale of roe on the Yukon River? Are we going to allow that again? What does it mean? I say it needs to be defined. None of these issues are addressed by the governor's bill, by the way. I'm going to pass. I realize you have a lot of people to testify. I would hope that we would, you know, pointing these out, I'd like to close with a couple major points. One, I think that the governor's approach is a blackmail approach, trying to force the legislature to deal with this major issue in 30 days or less. He's resurrecting the worst type of horror stories. Boards are doing the same thing to try to convince you that if you don't act, there's going to be complete chaos in the regulatory process. I would submit to you that that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. It can be if the governor and the board so choose. However, you know, a few innovative ideas might be brought to the forward, like there are other options for the legislature. We've offered one. One, this legislature could pass a statute putting a temporary freeze on subsistence regulations that existed prior to Madison, if that's what you want to do. The other thing is you might require that these unknown subsistence users have to pre-register prior to the date, so at least you know how many there were out there when they went out to fish. This has been a major point of the boards. We don't know how many people are going to be there. There's nothing in law that prohibits you from requiring pre-registration before subsistence users are allowed to participate. I think the approach that's being taken, unless it's carefully handled, is going to raise to the equal levels we did occur during the initiative, the rural-urban battle again. And I, for one, think that's a terrible mistake unless this is done, you know, in a logical process. I've already mentioned there are other alternatives. But I think the most important thing is, and this was illustrated, I think, in this recent Fisheries Committee meeting I attended last Thursday, is legislators are being asked to now disenfranchise 85% of the public. I mean, the dip netters in Fairbanks, most of the people who take game for food, are allowed to participate as subsistence users in these subsistence uses identified by the board. You're being told that every potential subsistence use will probably have to be identified and allowed under if they were brought in front of a petition in front of the boards. You're asking the legislators to, in fact, tell their constituents in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and Ketchikan, at least, because they happen to live in Juneau. I resent that personally, and I think a lot of the people here who do take those resources for food resent it. Before you permanently exclude 85% of Alaskans from any subsistence priority, it is politically advisable that they be allowed ample opportunity to personally voice their opinion. And I think that calls for, as a senator said, legislative hearings during the interim, go through a process here for a year of determining what sort of permanent changes should be made to the law. I, for one, this is my personal opinion, would certainly support, if you want to find out how the public really feels, put a couple of initiatives on the ballot, an advisory position, see how the public feels. Should subsistence be based on need? Should subsistence be primarily taken for food? I think you find a lot of the public in the state feel exactly that way. One last point. This administration has been illegally providing a select group of people first priority use of a common property resource. Logic would dictate that caution should be exercised before you make it legal. The governor's letter he just turned out here, I think, emphasized that point. They want you to provide the boards the same regulatory authority they had before the Madison case. They didn't have the regulatory authority. They interpreted it that way. They purposely went out with the process of implementing the law the way they wanted it to be, but they didn't have the legal authority to do that. The courts just said that. Now, you're going to make a major policy decision giving those courts authority, or giving the administration authority they did not have. And I'm saying, please give the people in this state, at least 80,000 of them who voted for the initiative, an ample opportunity to voice their opinion. I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I hope we'll have a chance again. Thank you.
Thank you. Very definitely, there will be additional hearings scheduled, and you will have the opportunity. At this time, we do have a Ms. Cora, is it Sokolov? Okay. Knutsi, is that how you pronounce that?
Knutsi. Knina.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and for allowing me to speak here today. Can you hear me?
Yes, yeah, but you need your name for the record.
My name is Cora Sokolov, and I'm representing the Knutsi Indian Tribe. The Knutsi Indian Tribe would like to go on record as opposing Governor House Bill 288. I don't want to take a lot of your time today. However, there's been statements made in the past that has never been addressed by the Knutsi Indian Tribe that have direct effect here today. It's important for everyone to know of the history of the Knutsi Dena'ina Indians before statements are made, such as the Knutsi tribe is a dispersed tribe without a village. Well, I looked up dispersed, and dispersed says, and I quote, to cause to break up, B, to cause to become spread widely. Well, there are reasons behind that. The tribal and family structure during the years were quickly being crumbled by growth and outside influence. Our pride and our integrity were slowly diminishing. The oil boom came, everything happened so fast. Before we knew it, we have Kenai, supposedly called now an urban town. There was pride in our family unit, integrity for hunting and carving and fishing. That statement was made by the Board of Fisheries about the Knutsi being a dispersed tribe, but not for the first time. There's been, whenever we done something, especially with the subsistence, while the Knutsi people don't do that, they're a dispersed tribe. Or in the Board of Fisheries has also said that the Knutsis are too heterogeneous. Well, I looked up heterogeneous and it says consisting of dissimilar ingredients or constituents, mixed. Well, we're mixed people. I don't know anybody who's not mixed one way or the other. One of the back in the tutorial days, the Knutsi Indians were ridiculed and shamed into conforming. What a better way to conform than I know of is into marrying into it. all this is leading to a point, and I hope you'll bear with me. The Dena'ina Indians were assimilated by, not by choice, but by force. We were forced out of our homelands. We moved apart and we spread. It has also been said that the Kenaitse are not a sharing people and that there is no evidence that group interchange occurs. To us, you don't have subsistence without sharing. Families share within families. Families share with extended families or elders in the community who have no other resources. Families trade. I have a net, you help, and you receive half the fish. Fish is distributed, clams, moose, berries. We never let anything go to waste. Subsistence is a choice of a quality of life, which we choose to enjoy to this day. Don't change that. If you establish a personal use fish, that will not allow us to take the early smelt hooligan harvest, which will be coming shortly and which only lasts for a short time. Don't divide Alaskans into two different divisions of people, rural and urban, because we're not. We all live in Alaska, whether we live in north, southeast, south central. I was born and raised in Kenai. My family is from Kenai, born and raised. 0.5% is not so much fish to worry about. And the resources and the fish stocks, the commercial sport and the subsistence, they all have valid arguments to the taking of fish stocks. I'm saying do not make something legal which has been illegal in the past. So I'm asking for your consideration. Thank you for your time here today, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Next person I'd like to have to come forth and Sid Morgan. Before you begin, Sid, just wondering, is there anyone from out of town that may not have the opportunity to testify before this committee on this issue? You raise your hand. Okay, good.
Good morning,
thank
Mr.
You.
Chairman. Thank you. My name is Sid Morgan, and I'm senior. I have resided in Alaska for over 31 years. 26 of those years were spent in the conservation of fish and wildlife resources in Alaska. And I've worked both with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And I'm going to keep my statements brief. I just want to say that I oppose the Band-Aid approach that Governor Sheffield is proposing in his subsistence legislation, House Bill 288, and also the companion bill, Senate Bill 231. The whole subsistence issue is not going to go away until its solution is reached that treats all Alaskans equally. And I'd like to add that I wholeheartedly support Mr. Somerville's testimony to it. It was an excellent presentation. That's all I had to do.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Okay. Greg Cook, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gall. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Greg Cook. I'm here representing myself and not any particular organization. I'm an attorney here in Juneau and have met a number of you during the years when I worked with the Department of Fish and Game. I have some brief comments to make that are based primarily on the March 6, 1985 memorandum from the Attorney General to Governor Sheffield. At one point in that memorandum, the Attorney General states, because the court ruled on statutory construction and legislative intent alone without reaching any constitutional issues, the legislature may act. That bothers me quite a bit, more because of what it does not say than what it says. The legislature has no more and no less power than it did as a result of the Madison decision. The legislature still has to act within constitutional limits anytime it passes a statute. What I would like to call this committee's attention to are two specific portions of Article 8 of our state constitution. Article 8 is the section that deals with natural resources. Senator Bennett has called that body's attention to Section 3, known as the Common Use Section. I'd emphasize that to the committee also, but in particular, I'd like to emphasize Section 17 of Article 8. It's a section of the Constitution that you don't hear much about, but that should be very, very much in your minds as you assess this issue. Section 17 is an equal protection clause that is in addition to the normal equal protection clause we have in the Bill of Rights section of our Constitution. It reads as follows. It says that laws and regulations governing the use of natural resources shall apply equally to all persons similarly situated. I can't really give you, and you haven't asked for, a detailed opinion on how that section applies to the bill that has been submitted by the governor, but I think it would be remiss of me if I failed to call your attention to the fact that there may well be some substantial constitutional problems that you as a committee and the legislature as a whole should look at. The subsistence law that was passed in 1978 was a major allocative decision. Whether you agree with it or disagree with it, it's the law that we have on the books, and it is an action-forcing statute. It requires the boards to adopt regulations. The boards have quite broad flexibility in how they define the methods and means of harvest, and therefore who would be a subsistence user of fisheries and wildlife. I wouldn't want the legislature to be stampeded into action as a result of a parade of horribles that is raised by the agencies involved. I suggest that you take the time for a long and reflective look not only at public opinion on this issue or set of issues, but also to look at the variety of legal opinions that you're going to get. I think the look that you have had so far, the perspective you've been given, is very limited based on the amount of time you've had, and it requires a substantially greater amount of time and study before you take action. Whether or not the state can be in full compliance with ANILCA is certainly one of those issues. States do not have all the powers to discriminate among citizens that the federal government has. This is just one of a large number of issues. In closing, I'd like to emphasize once again that you look very carefully at the Alaska state constitutional requirements, the common use requirement, and the equal protection clause of Article 8, and look very closely at what public opinion is going to be before you take action on this matter. You may act swiftly, but I would urge you not to be stampeded into a quick fix solution that does not make you aware of the legal benefits and costs of what you do. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Greg. Rupe Andrews.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rupe Andrews, and I am here to represent today the National Rifle Association. In Alaska, we have 22,000 members. We have the highest per capita membership of the 50 states. I'm the Alaska field representative for the National Rifle Association, and as such, I'm here to speak on behalf of that organization today. We are an organization of shooters and hunters, and I would like to explain that, as Mr. Somerville did, we are not an urban organization. We are as much rural in Alaska as we are urban. I'm here today to express the concerns of this membership as regards House Bill 288 and as it impacts their privilege to hunt, fish, guide, and to outfit. I'm basically speaking in opposition to House Bill 288, properly referred to as the governor's quick fix bill, because HB 288 does not address all of the discrepancies as defined in the Madison decision by the Alaska Supreme Court. According to the state Supreme Court decision, changes needed to the state subsistence statute are indeed substantial. You've already heard testimony, but I will say it again, that foremost, the discrepancy that HB 288 fails to define is the term rural. The Madison decision struck down the 10 criteria that had been developed by the boards of Fish and Game. New criteria need to be developed to determine just who qualifies as rural and therefore has a subsistence priority to wild renewable resources, which I might add includes fish, wildlife, grasses, timber, and water. The Madison decision defined subsistence as a use. It did not define subsistence user. The intent of the 1978 statute has always been to protect subsistence use, as pointed out by the Supreme Court decision. And as a matter of information, and this was spoken to before by Mr. Somerville, the 1978 statute could not have passed, in the opinion of many and myself, I was part of some of those hearings, the Alaska State Legislature, if indeed it meant to give a subsistence priority only to rural residents of Alaska. The governor's bill, HB 288, is a radical departure, in our opinion, from the intent of the 1978 legislature. We propose that sufficient public input be obtained so that the deficiencies of the 78 statute be identified and corrected in any future statute. Sideboards must be put in place to limit and clarify the definition of customary and traditional on the basis of need. Presently, and in HB 288, unlimited subsistence use without restraint can take place. One can only look ahead to the future a short ways to see that all of the uses of wild renewable resources are moving towards elimination in preference to subsistence use. A future statute must define how subsistence use can be regulated. At present, it is not known whether unlimited numbers of moose can be taken or whether gill nets can be used to subsistence harvest the giant rainbow of Lake Eliambo. If indeed, in order to eliminate the chance of disruption to existing uses, that some action may be taken, I urge the committee to look at a moratorium so that a reflective and concentrated interest of this committee and the legislature be developed with the help of the public input to correct the deficiencies of the 78 legislation and the present HB 288 and any future permanent legislation. I want to thank this committee for the opportunity to talk to you today.
Thank you. Thank you. And I'm sorry, Representative Gall, I talked to you for a second ago, but you want to come forth and submit the information that we have there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Peter Gall. I'm chairman of the House Committee on Community and Regional Affairs and the House Special Committee on Fisheries. I'm here today to just make a few brief remarks at your request. I'll defer the substance of my testimony to a later time. First of all, I'd like to say that most of the background on the position of the Fisheries Committee has been submitted to you. I'd like to call your attention, of course, to Representative Fuller's packet, which I think is an admirable job of outlining the legal issues. I think it's, maybe I should preface my little list of things that I'm going to pass around by just saying that some of the comments that have been made today, in my view, reflect back to the period of the referendum which we had on the subsistence issue. The referendum did receive a decisive turn down, if you will, by the voters, and the subsistence law remains with us today. I believe that one of the reasons for that is a recognition that we do have many people in our rural areas of the state who require some specific protections, and we also have areas of the state where competition is fierce. But the issues that came to a head during the beginning of last legislature when the members of the Board of Fisheries came up for confirmation and the Copper River issue reached a head might recall for a moment the fact that the Board of Fisheries has managed to resolve, and I point out the Copper River resolution, the creation of a personal use category by the board, was subsequent to the filing of this Madison case. And many of the issues between user groups, which were so hot at that point, have cooled tremendously as the personal use category has proven itself very successful.
in resolving some of the personal use needs of our urban users. I will speak to that more when I do come back to testify on my own behalf, but today I'd like to ask Roger, if he would, to pass out a few things. Last Friday, I forwarded a letter on subsistence adopted by the Fisheries Committee, and that is in your packet. That letter specifically does request prompt but thorough action on the bill and hopes for a resolution of the issue during this legislative year. Requests House action sufficiently expedient to get the bill to the Senate and allow for a vote to take place. In addition, I forwarded a resolution by the Joint Boards of Fisheries and Game that were referred to in the testimony of Mr. Bonney, and that is in your packet at this time. Today, Roger is handing out to you copies of the transcript of the March 21st Fisheries Committee meeting, which includes presentations such as those you heard this morning and also others in addition. I'd also like to have you take a look at the letter which is being handed out, which outlines the potential fiscal impacts on the state of noncompliance with ANILCA. Rather than go on to make substantive comments on the bill, I'll stop at this time. I would like to respectfully, though, request the members of the committee to be as immune to emotionally charged rhetoric as you possibly can. The legal issues before us are not as complex as some would have one think. The Alaska National Interests Lands Conservation Act, ANILCA, defines subsistence users. The Board of Fisheries has made an effort to be consistent with federal law in order to protect the users of this state and to protect the state's ability to manage fish and game. The Madison decision has pointed out that the Board's responsiveness to federal law is not sufficiently supported by state law, and the governor is seeking to resolve that issue by making the necessary corrections in state law. If you support or do not support those corrections, that's one thing. But the issue itself is fairly straightforward, and it is a legal issue, and I think should be looked at least as much as possible as a legal issue as well as a political issue. And I'd like to just restate once again that the regulations of the Board of Fisheries were the elements which kept us consistent with federal law. The regulations over the last 2 years were the elements which eliminated so much of the controversy which existed during the time of the referendum, and making our law consistent with both federal law and the regulations which implement it is certainly a worthy goal. Whether or not, as I say, you support the approach is something for the committee to determine. But some of the phrases that I've heard in reference to the governor's bill are very defamatory and really don't relate to the problem before you. And so for the third time, I'd respectfully request that you look carefully at the legal issues and try to guard yourselves from political rhetoric from any side. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Linda Bell. This time, Greg Young.
My name is Greg Young. I'm a resident of Juneau, and I'm representing myself. I'm also concerned about the quickness that we're trying to fix this problem, and I haven't yet really think I've heard anybody state what I think are some of the problems leading to this. We have to realize that our resource base is finite. It's not going to get any larger. We also have to realize that our population is growing continually. Right now, Alaska is still one of the largest or fastest growing states in the country. Previously, when the population was small, there wasn't any issue because there were sufficient resources. People were spread out enough. There wasn't the competition there exists today for the resources. People traditionally took fish and game in methods that they had used or were taught to them from their relatives or other people, or methods they saw other people use. Today, we have people arguing that they're taking fish and game using traditional methods, and I've heard some of those methods being used that date back maybe 20 years, some date back 60 years, some date back 100 years. Some of the methods and uses date back thousands of years. What is traditional, and when does traditional start? How is this issue going to be dealt with? Because if it's going to be the resources are going to be allocated based on traditional use, a decision has to be made and has to be made soon. What is going to be traditional for each group? Once that decision is made, probably it can be accepted. It's going to be a hard bullet for a lot of people to bite, but sometime the decision has to be made. Let's try to make it now and not hurry up and make it too quickly. Let's make that decision. The perceived fairness of this decision is going to relate how well this is dealt with. Personally, I don't think that a traditional use of snowmobiles is the same as a traditional use. Let's use the example of taking fish to feed a dog team as a traditional use. If you no longer have a dog team and start using a snowmobile, your traditional use has changed. If an allocation is made, and I'll try to cut this off pretty quickly, we have to realize that once an allocation is made of these resources, that as the population grows, people are going to get a smaller and smaller piece of the action. But an allocation has to be made, and it might as well be made now. The situation isn't going to go away, and I think what we're doing now is treating the symptoms and not really dealing with the problems. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. At this time, we are approaching adjournment. We do have two or three people left that haven't had an opportunity to testify, and we will be carrying this on over until tomorrow for further testimony, for further hearing. Representative Chung, you have a question?
Yeah, I'd like to request some information from the staff, if I could, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
I would like to get a copy of all of the briefs submitted on both sides in the case, both in the Supreme Court and in the Superior Court. I think the AG's office should have them upstairs.
We'll continue on tomorrow.
The other side. Also, Mr. Chairman, I'd request maybe you could make an inquiry of the attorneys who were on the other side of the case who won this argument and see if they wouldn't be willing to present their issues to the committee.
Certainly.
Representative Fuller. Just one short question, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Apparently, you're opening this up now to testimony from everyone.
It is a hearing on this piece of legislation. We have to hear the people that are here today.
Well, how about the other people in other areas that want to?
Yes, we're going to have to set up a teleconference, no question. Right. For testimony?
Yeah. Right. Some of what I've heard here is the same as testimony from individuals rather than informational. And
right.
I think that if we're going to have it this way, then it should be open to everyone. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Right. I agree with you, Representative Fuller, but we've got to do that. Tomorrow we were going to continue on with the same format that we had here today. Then if there's other, which I assume there will be, future hearings held on this, we'll have to open it up to all the teleconferencing sites and allow the people to testify from the outlying areas.
Yeah, I just have one more request as we get into testimony. I know it's kind of awkward, but I'd appreciate an opportunity to ask some questions of some of these witnesses, particularly if they're not going to be back again,
right,
or we don't have an opportunity to follow up with them in the future. I know some of the guys are going to be here for a long haul, and those I'll talk to individually.
I anticipated that there would have been more people here from the Department of Law, Fish and Game, et cetera. I thought that they would probably have more to say on the legislation, and I didn't figure that we would even have time to get to public testimony today. So, anyway, with that, we definitely will open it up to questions as we get into it. With that, resources are